Thank you so much for coming. It's very special for Liz and I. This has been our spiritual home for 22 years, and many of you have followed our work and supported us and prayed for us, and some here, the Boyds, have been following us for even maybe 40 years, so it's a pleasure to come back and speak a little bit about the work. So the boy from Myrtleford with the Oscar award-winning filmmaker, how does that happen? So I grew up in Myrtleford, and perhaps three things shaped my life. I loved God's creation, and I swam in that river and fished in it. I climbed some of those trees and the hills behind our place. I just loved being in God's creation. And perhaps the third thing was the strong faith of my mother, and the idea that life's not just about financial security. There's more to life than that, and we have a responsibility to care for creation, and we are our brother's keeper. But there were a few things happening in my childhood that really upset me, and I think I was quite an angry kid, but the bushland that I love was being bulldozed and left fallow for years on end, and even though I didn't have an understanding of ecology, it didn't add up to me that we needed to do things in that way. Of course we need progress, of course we need plantations and so on, but why was it so destructive? And the biodiversity was lost, there was erosion, and so on and so forth. And in my valley, they grew tobacco and used very toxic sprays. So in that river that I love so much, sometimes fish would come floating down, belly up. And at the same time, I'd watch the news, I'd read articles. We were growing tobacco with our precious irrigation water and farmland, and children just like me, who through no fault of their own, were going to bed hungry every day. And I think I was quite cross. Why was the adult world wired that way? Why was there so much injustice? But I felt powerless. And I just threw up a child's prayer. Please, Lord, use me somehow, somewhere to make a difference. And I think I've tried to stay true to that prayer all of my life. I went to university to study agriculture, and I thought, I'll never find a girl mad enough to want to live with me in a mud hut in the middle of Africa. Well, I was wrong. I found one. And, you know, I'm the one standing up here. I'm the one getting the awards and the recognition, but actually it's a team effort. And Liz has been by my side all these years, supporting me, coming up with brilliant ideas of her own, putting the wheels back on the cart when they fall off, and a wonderful encouragement and helpmate. So, but university was quite a struggle for me, and I thought, well, who do I think I am? What difference did I think I could make? I had a lot of doubts, a lot of uncertainty about the future, and, you know, where was all this heading? And at that time, a friend gave me a Bible, and I got in the habit of reading every morning. But no matter where I read in the Bible, I'd keep coming back to Ephesians 2:10. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which he prepared beforehand. And I just love that. It gave me hope. I don't know what or when or how. Maybe I don't have the capability, but that's okay. God knows. And he's already prepared that work for me to do. And it sort of kept me going. I just found university such a drudgery, sitting at the desk and listening to lectures. But those words kept me going. And we were married. We went to Bible college for a year. We joined Serving in Mission, a mission organisation that works across Africa and many other parts of the world. And we were assigned to Niger Republic in West Africa. And I remember in those early days when we had just enough language under our belt to be dangerous and a small understanding of the culture. And my predecessor started taking me to the villages to visit, because he was to leave a couple of months after we arrived. It was a bit scary, actually. And one evening, I sat down, and there was a lantern, and it was getting dark, and there was a circle of other guys around, just chatting and bantering, good humour, stories, hardships, things that were good. And it was just as if I had an out-of-body experience, and I felt, oh, I'm really happy. I feel like I'm meant to be here. And then that verse dawned on me. Yes, this is the work that God had prepared beforehand. It just felt right. I couldn't explain it in any other way, but really I'd come home. But despite feeling that I was in the right place, it was no bed of roses. Life was tough for the people. And what had been a dry land, biodiverse forest at the time I was growing up in Myrtleford, by the time we arrived there, it was almost at the point of ecological collapse, barely able to support life on Earth. And this is not in the middle of the Sahara Desert. It's actually their productive farmland, or I should say unproductive farmland. And so decades of land clearing, and what we didn't know then was yes, definitely had probably the biggest effect, but at the same time the climate was changing. And of any region in the world, West Africa's probably had the biggest step down in average rainfall of any other region, 25 to 30% drop in rainfall. And the consequences of that destruction and in combination with climate change were very, very serious. People struggled to make a living, but even to survive some years. We were involved in famine relief 5 separate years. And even in the non-famine years, people rarely grew enough food to see them through the whole year. And so as the trees were removed, the frequency and the severity of droughts increased. The quality of the soil reduced, because trees are very, very important for putting and maintaining fertility of that soil, the carbon, the nitrogen, and so many other things. We normally have an 8-month dry season in Niger, but if you get a drought on top of that, it's just devastating for the crops, but also for the livestock. And there's no social security, there's no big brother watching over you. You're pretty much on your own and within your clan and village for your support. So people experienced hunger frequently, there was displacement, as many people perhaps seasonally would have to leave their village, go to the nearest city or even to the neighbouring countries in order to find food and work to send back home. Usually, unless it was a very severe year, usually the women and children stayed home and the men might be away for 6 months, 8 months. During the famine years, sometimes the men never came back. And so in my mind, I thought, well, if deforestation is one of the root causes of all these problems, then bingo, it's easy. Let's just put trees back in that landscape. And I did everything within my power to do that. We were, within my knowledge too, we were raising trees initially in a central nursery and then carting them out to the villages and working with the village people to get those trees back in. I researched whatever I could get my hands on. I consulted people who had experience in replanting trees in that region, and I experimented. Different species, different methods, you name it, we did it. And those two pictures, I've deliberately chosen them to try and give you the context that miserable little effort, those trees, in contrast to the vast barren landscape behind them, this was getting a little bit wearing. Nothing that we tried worked in an economically viable, sustainable or satisfying way. And to add injury to insult, the community's called Tony the crazy white farmer. I mean, he's really lost it. Who in their right mind would want to give up their precious farmland to plant trees on it? And especially every year, we're on the edge of hunger as it is, and he wants us to give up our precious land to do this. So there wasn't much enthusiasm for what I was trying to get them to do. And they knew much more than me anyway. The trees wouldn't belong to them. The policies were such that all trees belonged to the government. And there was no real incentive for people to put that effort in to care for something they might not benefit from. And so I guess when you're young, you're pretty ambitious and you want to, you know, make your mark and have an impression. 2.5 years of struggling and not getting much positive reaction from the villagers, I was pretty low. And there were times when I could have given up and just gone home, just thrown in the towel. And I thought, how many million dollars would it take? How many decades would it require? How many staff would you need to even make a dent on this landscape? And I knew in my mind, using these methods in this way, it was hopeless. It wasn't going to work. And I was wasting my time, waste of money and time. And actually, I didn't spend millions of dollars. He was talking in general about reforestation projects. But we did spend money. We had staff. We had vehicles. We did spend money. And there was nothing to show for it. And it was on one of these days when I had my ute and trailer load of seedlings, taking them out to the villages, knowing full well that people weren't interested. Most of those trees, perhaps in excess of 80%, would die and it wouldn't have any impact. And I just threw up another prayer. I thought, God, you didn't have to bring me to Africa to make a fool of me. You could have done that back in Australia. But I threw up a prayer asking God for forgiveness for destroying the gift of his creation. And it was deliberately a collective prayer. Maybe I wasn't personally responsible for destroying that landscape, but in our consumptive lifestyle here, our waste and pollution and so on, we're all contributing to the destruction of the environment in some way. Forgive us for destroying the gift of your creation, as a consequence of which people are suffering. They're hungry, they're poor, they're fearful for tomorrow. They don't know what tomorrow will bring. You still love us. Show us what to do. Open our eyes. Help us. And, this wasn't a setup. It wasn't exactly this day, but it was a situation like this. And on this day, I'd been on this road for 2.5 years, almost weekly. And eyes open, but absolutely blind to what had been all around us that whole time. And on this particular day, that innocuous-looking bush. And for all I knew, it could have been a weed, it could have been a desert bush, but on this day it caught my attention. And I took the trouble to go over a little bit closer and take a better look. And immediately, for most species, when you see the leaf, it's like a signature. You can tell what species that is. As soon as I saw the leaf, I realized it's not a bush, it's not a weed, it's a tree. And if you brush the sand away, there's a tree stump under there. And it's resprouting, and it resprouts every year, trying to become a tree again. But the normal practice for farming is people slash that regrowth. And as a visitor to that country, as an expatriate, you're not really fully aware of what's going on. All you see is bushes, because they never get above 1 metre. So every year the farmers are slashing it, but that tree, that bush wants to become a tree again. And in that instant, when I saw it for what it really was, in my mind, everything changed. This was the answer to that prayer. This was the solution that we were looking for. I wasn't fighting the Sahara Desert. I didn't need multiple millions of dollars to solve this problem. I didn't need a miracle species of tree that could withstand the goats and the ploughing and the fire and so on. Everything that you needed was literally at your feet. And the battle lines shifted from a technical, perhaps financial battle to one of mindsets. And if it was people's beliefs about trees and the environment, if it was their negative attitudes and their destructive practices that brought the environment to its knees, barely able to support life, then that's where the real battle was. And if I could just convince people that it's in your best interest to work with nature, that you and your children will have a better future if you allow some of these trees to come back on your land and to provide all the goods and services that God created them to provide, the windbreak, the lowering of temperatures, the increasing of soil fertility, the natural pest control, because insect-eating birds and lizards and so on will now have a home to live in. If you would just go on this journey with me, then let's see where it takes us, and I think it'll make things better. And so actually a lot of people are surprised. I get the marketing guys have a ball with me. They call me the forest maker, and there was one headline, the tree whisperer, and so on. And so people are really quite surprised when I tell them 95% of my time has nothing to do with the technical side of trees or landscapes. I'm in the business of regreening mindscapes. And if I put it in a different way, I think I put the slide in there, but years later in Tanzania, a farmer grabbed me by the hand and took me to this, what had been a tree stump, but there was a tree emerging from it. And he said, "This tree used to be my enemy. And I'm so ashamed. I learned about FMNR and I'm so ashamed that I tried to destroy it. And now it's my friend." And I thought, yes, I'm in the business of turning enemies into friends. So on the one hand, the work that I do, this thing called farmer-managed natural regeneration, it's a technical pruning practice, which I'll describe in a minute. But on the other hand, it's very much a development approach. It's about creating awareness and enabling people and empowering people and working with mindsets. And that's much of what I do, getting people to become friends with nature and with trees. And so the technical side of it is actually, like on the film, embarrassingly simple and actually nothing new. This is an ancient technique. We see it if you go into a vineyard in the wintertime when the farmer has pruned all those excess branches and just left two. You could say he's doing a form of FMNR. It's farmer managed. He selected the shoots that he wants for a certain purpose to get more grapes, and he's managed that regrowth. That's all we're doing here. When you have a tree that's been cut down, for most species, and especially our gums, they're amongst the best at resprouting, then it's going to sprout profusely. And if you do nothing, then maybe it'll become a tree, but it will take a decade or more because there's so much competition. Maybe 30, 50 stems, all competing for the same light and water and nutrients and even space. And all we do, this farmer-managed bit, all we do is say, well, let's just pick the very best ones, the tallest, straightest, most robust, and we'll cull out the excess and give those good ones a little bit of space. And that's all it is, embarrassingly simple, but incredibly effective. And, you know, so which species? How many per hectare? How will I prune it? I rarely answer those questions because it's farmer managed and we'll work it out as we go. And I can honestly say there'd be no two farms, no two forests under this approach that are exactly the same because it's farmer or community or pastoralist managed in such a way as to help them achieve their own objectives. And so why do I call it the underground forest? And if we had special vision, if God had given us eyesight to see into the ground, we'd quickly realize that when you cut a tree down, for most species, it's not the end of the story. And up to 50% of the mass of the tree is still there, but hidden underground. And so instead of planting a little seedling that's got quite a small root mass and it's subject to drought, it'll probably die if the goats nibble it too often and so on, we've got this massive root system there with access to moisture, even in the heart of the dry season, nutrients, stored sugars. And I like to compare it to a V8 engine. And the engine's switched on, but the vehicle's not in gear. And it's just idling away and really, really keen to do what God created it to do, to become a tree again. But it's being stopped. People cutting it for fuel wood, ploughing it, burning it, grazing it constantly. And the FMNR thing, the farmer-managed thing, is putting that engine into gear and allowing nature to do what God engineered it to do. And so I thought, yes, let's go for it. And it was probably 1983, I found about 10 keen farmers in as many villages. And I said, look, I think this will work. I don't really know, but I think it'll work. Would you be willing to try it on a small corner of your land? If it's a failure, if it causes you problems, it's your farm, cut the trees out. But let's just try it and see where it takes us. And it was working. Not one of those trees there was planted. These are all coming up from stumps and perhaps some from seeds. And it was working. And within 5-6 months, we had trees up 1 meter, 1.5 meters tall. But, you know, in traditional societies, nobody wants to be different. And there are jealousies, and there are extreme needs, and there are scores to settle. And it would have failed in 1983 because people were cutting out these trees. It would have failed that year. But that year was also a severe drought year and led to extreme hunger. Many of the men left either for the city that we lived in, Maradi, or beyond into Nigeria. Women were left to make do as best they could. That particular group of women, there were no men left in the village. There was one small remnant bushland, a little some kilometres from their village. They'd gotten up at 2 a.m. in the morning, walked to that spot, picked the berries. By the time they got back, it was about midday, but you can't just cook them or eat them raw. They're actually toxic. And so they would have to soak them for a number of hours, throw that water out, soak them again. I think if you do it properly, you need to do it at least 3 times. Then you can cook it and eat it. And it's actually quite nutritious and tasty. But many people, maybe they've forgotten the process or they're too hungry to do it properly. People died eating this stuff if they weren't careful. But this is how desperate people got. They're eating, in some cases, bran. If animals had died, they'd eat the rotting dead meat and so on. And for me, it was devastating, really. Weren't these the people I'd come to serve? What do I tell them? Yes, God loves you, but not in times of famine. Because I wasn't getting any encouragement from the authorities or even from some in our mission. They didn't think it was our role. And the pressure was building up because the mission had actually conducted relief some years prior in the 70s famines. There was this expectation and people started camping around our house. And I'd literally have to push through the crowd. I'd get up in the morning. We're trying to get permissions, trying to get funding, trying to find grain. You have to push through the people to get to your car. I remember one day very distinctly, little Ben, how old was he, hon?
Three.
They were stopping me from getting to their car. And Ben puts his hands on his hips and he says in perfect accent, Bakushiba, Yachiba, Da Vinci. Didn't you hear? He hasn't got any grain. Let him go. Everybody stopped and the path divided. But it was very difficult. And there I was. One of the things that got me there in the first place was seeing children just like me hungry, and I felt powerless. There was no grain. We had no money. And you, as an expat, you can't just go and do your own thing. You can't distribute grain anyway. You need permission. And the Préfet, the equivalent of the Premier at that time, for his own reasons, wanted to block the mission from distributing food and perhaps influencing people for Christianity. But these were my friends. They weren't some unknown figure on the other side of the world that I watched through a television. I'd slept in their huts, I'd eaten their food, and we'd reciprocated when they came to town. And they were suffering. They were leaving home. In some cases, their children were dying. And so I was quite devastated. And one morning I was making a half attempt to read my Bible. And the Bible was open on the table and maybe not very spiritual. I was trying to eat my breakfast, but a lump formed in my throat and tears were starting to come. And my eyes fell on the open page of the Bible. Fear not and be not dismayed by this great multitude. And there really were a lot of people camping around our house by this great multitude. For the battle is not yours, but mine, says the Lord. And this great weight lifted off me. I didn't know what, I didn't know how or even when, but I knew God was going to do something very, very dramatic. And within 2 weeks, the premier passed away. He died. I didn't pray for that. And they put the mayor of the city, an old friend of the mission, they put him in as interim premier. And he said, "What's the problem?" He gave us the permission. Over the next 12 months, mainly through SIM, we received from small and large donors around the world, churches, individuals, $500,000. We purchased 1,800 tons of grain, and we helped somewhere between 30 and 50,000 people. And the reason why it's not an exact number is if you feed one person in Africa, you feed a village. It's the Italian in me coming out. So maybe up to 50,000 people. I mentioned to a friend, I marvelled at how quickly we got the permission. He said, "Don't be silly." He was probably scared you'd pray for him too. But this was also the turning point in the FMNR story. There was a ruling by the government that you can't just give out food for free. We don't want to create dependency. If people are able-bodied, they have to work for it. And it really played into our hands. And so we devised a program where for every family that was receiving food aid, and we distributed food once a month, then there was a requirement for every hectare of farmland, we want you to regenerate 40 trees. And we'll check every month before food distribution, we'll check. And it was working beautifully. We gave out food for the next 6 months or so, and this is now 1984. People started regenerating trees, and I thought, yes, now step by step after the famine, we'll really roll this out. We'll be cooking with gas. And, you know, when we stopped the food distribution, probably in September 1984, people said, "Finished with that, Tony. Let's get on with our lives." And they started cutting those trees down. 75% of 500,000 trees cut out overnight. But I had a critical mass. 25% said, "Yeah, perhaps that guy's a bit crazy, but it didn't do any harm." And in God's providence, 1984 was actually a bumper year. They had good rains and they had excellent crops. So having the trees in the cropland didn't do any harm. And the crops, the yield was actually much, much more than you would normally expect. And so the observant ones, these 25% said, "No, we're going to persevere and take this another year and see where it takes us." And from that small catalytic group, you know, I could have not been there from that point on, because the FMNR story is a farmer's story. It spread organically from farmer to farmer. Certainly we assisted it along the way, but that was the start of literally a green revolution. And you can see there farmers who their fathers would have turned in the grave. They would have called them dirty farmer, leaving trees in their cropland. "You're lazy." Now leaving trees. And surprise, surprise, not only were these trees not diminishing the yield or making less fodder available for the animals, the yield was doubling. And there was more fodder than ever for the livestock. And ironically, counterintuitively, even in a drought year, you can see the only place where the crop is not only surviving, it's actually thriving, is at the base of the tree. It doesn't make sense. It's shady there. The tree's taking up space. What's happening? And in our calculations, well, it's cooler. There's more organic matter. It's more fertile. Less wind. There's insect-eating lizards there. And all that's true. What we only learnt about 10 years ago, some researchers in Senegal did experiments. These trees are bio-irrigating the crop. They're drawing water from deep in the water table, and at nighttime they leak through the shallow roots, effectively irrigating the nearby crop. Just the amazing intricacy of God's creation and how it all works together. And I'm not denigrating science or progress or anything, but when we think we know better, when we work against the principles of nature, that there are consequences. And when we work with it, there's such an incredible outcome. And so in the following 20 years, from 1984, FMNR spread across the country roughly at a rate of 250,000 hectares per year for 20 years. An average tree density of about 4 trees per hectare rose to roughly 40 trees across 5 million hectares, equating to about 200 million trees without planting a single tree. And most of that without my knowledge. I knew what was happening locally. Our team, we sent farmers to the four corners of Niger whenever there was a request. We sent sometimes our staff. We received visitors, farmers groups, other non-government organisations, foresters. Nobody ever bothered to say, Tony, it was a failure. Or, Tony, it was great. Look at what we're doing. So my whole time in Niger until 1999, we hoped we'd had an impact beyond our district, but we had no idea. And it wasn't until 2004, I'd already joined World Vision, and I met a Dutchman, Chris Ray, and had the opportunity to go back to Niger. We're in an outdoor restaurant, and he had a pen, bang the pen down on the table, and he said, Tony, enough talk, it's time for action. And that's when I learned it had spread to 5 million hectares. And Chris, bless him, he's gone around the world. He's brought journalists to Niger. He's brought Nigerian farmers to Congress to testify and created a lot of awareness globally on what's happened, but to wake people up. Why aren't we doing this wherever it's applicable? The impact in Niger on that 5 million hectares, and it's actually increased beyond 5 million. That was after 20 years. It's increased significantly since then. But by virtue of getting that tree cover back on farmland, Nigerian farmers are growing an additional 500,000 tonnes of grain per year, enough to feed 2.5 million people every year, without fertilisers, without irrigation, without improved seed. Not saying that we can't bring that in. Of course, in some cases we can and get even better yields. It was simply by virtue of working with nature instead of against it. Gross incomes, the value of what people consume, the firewood, the extra grain, the traditional medicines, the wild foods, gross incomes every year, without subsidy, without non-government support or government decrees, is worth $900 million, about up to $1,000 per household across 4.5 million households. And I put the pause button there. Those are big numbers, and if you're like me, it sort of washed over. We're in the poorest country in the world. It's often listed as the poorest country. It's certainly always in the bottom 10. We're in an extremely harsh environment on the edge of the Sahara Desert. Our mission, the amount that we spent on this is minuscule compared to some very, very large projects, just minuscule. And the people responsible for that transformation weren't the scientists, the politicians, or even the missionaries or non-government people. It was the farmers, the poorest, most risk-averse, most unlikely people to do something like that achieve this. So I wanted to make that point. I'll put the pause there to labour on it. This is significant. I've seen, I've been in development now for more than 40 years. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't work. There's a lot of stuff that works, but once the last dollar is spent, that's the last action that's taken. This has continued beyond the life of the last investment and continues to this day. What was started in Niger and spread across that country is now going global. And I had the great privilege of joining World Vision in 1999. And I thought, yes, the world's my oyster. World Vision works in 100 countries. All of them are impacted to one degree or another by deforestation. And, of course, that affects livelihoods. It affects children. Let me at it. But I struggled. From 1999 till 2012, we didn't make much progress. I had a lot to learn. But that blue line there, a friend joined World Vision and he said, it's a no-brainer. We've got to do this. He helped create a website. He secured a small budget so that I wouldn't wait for some field office to magically learn about the work and invite me over. I now had a small budget to be proactive and go to the most likely countries that might be receptive, and I went for it. That figure there is out of date now. There's probably 26 World Vision countries that we've been able to introduce it to, and it's not like they're all new Niger. Some are well on the way. It's a spectrum. So some have done extremely well. Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda. Others may be very, very early on the journey. It's just starting to pick up. But through World Vision, we're able to introduce it into all those regions. Plus, the problem is too large. Land degradation, poverty, climate change. It's too large even for a World Vision to solve alone. Being in this position gave me the freedom to network, to partner, to influence. And the organisation that Liz works for is a direct product of that. Well, it was present in a different form prior to 2012, but it really picked up speed since that year. And one of their main focuses is to promote FMNR globally, not as a single NGO. This is an alliance of all the big guys and many, many small guys as well. And so the world became my oyster. I had this great plan and vision how we're going to get the message out there. And we were doing face-to-face workshops. We were doing conferences. We got the website up, and then a little bit later, others helped design an online training course. They figured out there's only one Tony and he's getting old. How can we multiply the guy? And I thought, oh, it'll never work. This is hands-on stuff. You've got to be there face-to-face. But I humoured them. I let them go ahead with it. And you know, through that online training, we've trained more than 200 people. And it's been extremely effective. The last cohort was the first time we could open up to non-World Vision people. We had 40 participants. Over 30 of them were from other organisations, from Syria, from Afghanistan, from places I've never visited, from organisations I've never spoken to. And so it's multiplying, and fortunately I was wrong and they were right. Online training is a wonderful vehicle for getting the message out there. But from 2012 we went a bit ballistic and started to take the message to other countries with these face-to-face workshops. And around the time of the first conference in 2012, I asked Liz, would you take long leave without pay and come with me? I want to do 4 months. I want to visit a number of countries before we wind up in Nairobi, where that conference was. And we had wonderful time, workshops, village meetings, training the World Vision staff and any other partners that would come along. And on the flight back, Liz said, what have you done to me? I can't go back and work in an office now. And so for the next few years, we were able to travel together regularly and we were a real team. Well, we're still a team, but it was very special to have that happening. And so just a few quick shots. This is northern Ghana. The conditions in the different countries are very, very different, but the principles are the same. And so over a six-year period... And I didn't deliberately cheat. You can't always determine what part of the year you come in. So this is dry season and this is wet season. But you can see the difference in the height of the trees. And there's a beautiful story, the very last slide there. So keep this scene in mind. The winds had become so strong, often their hut roofs were blowing off. They were suffering from drought one year and flood the next year. When you've got bare hills, it's all going to run off and flood your good agricultural land. The women in these villages were walking up to 4 hours every second day to collect the fuel wood. And things happen when women are out alone in the bush, either from wild animals or otherwise. And children weren't in school. The families were so poor that they needed the children to help with the wood and the water and the farming. The livestock were often hungry and they couldn't get a good price in the market. They would have to take them to distant sites, distant hills to get enough fodder. Often they'd get stolen there. Because it's such a distance, they'd come back more skinny than when they left, and the butchers would laugh at them, take that bag of bones away. So just keep that picture in mind, and we'll come back to the after story later. Uganda. This guy was always getting into fights with his neighbours. Because his own land was so barren, the hungry animals would get into the neighbours' crops. Adopted FMNR, more than enough fodder. He increased his stocking rate, oh, it was something like 400%. Without overgrazing. And in fact, he penned them up for part of the day. They're so well fed, they didn't need to graze all day. And they had no interest in going into the neighbours' miserable crops because they had enough food here. And what we don't perhaps realise in Australia, where our cows eat grass, the forest itself is fodder. The leaves, the seed pods, in some cases even the bark of the trees, is excellent fodder. So, yes, there's grass, but there's this aerial haystack as well. And he was so proud. He popped his chest out and he said, "Mr. Tony, I've put my kids through high school and I paid the school fees. I'm building a new house. I've got beehives. I have firewood. I sell poles." He was so proud. He'd done it using the resources that God had given him. East Timor, terrible landslides and flooding, lack of fodder because people have the practice of burning the hills every year. The principles work there. Even I think there's a 1500 millimetre rainfall zone. Ethiopia, one of my favourite projects. So World Vision entered this region and perhaps Ethiopia itself in 1984. The same drought famine we experienced in West Africa drew World Vision to enter Ethiopia in East Africa. And they started our a relief program, saved many thousands of lives, and then transitioned. There's a transition period, and then you go into development mode where you're building schools and health clinics. You're helping with improved agriculture and micro businesses. And I don't fault their work. World Vision does excellent work. But despite all of that development, for the next nearly 20 years, we were obliged to one degree or another to keep giving food aid, some years more, some years less. Despite their good work, they had not addressed the underlying issue of land degradation and its inability to sustainably support life. We started the restoration project, and this is a forest, it's not farmland, in 2006. Within 6 years, that historically food aid dependent community sold 106 tonnes of grain to the World Food Program. And they said, "Yeah, we have droughts too, like the rest of Ethiopia." In 2016, there was an El Nino in Ethiopia. The government and other NGOs and World Vision were feeding 10 million people across World Vision, across Ethiopia, but not here. They said, "Yeah, we experience drought, but whatever clouds are up there, when they hit our hill, they're more likely to drop their rain on us than on our neighbours." And yes, it's less rain in a year like that, but it's more effective. It's cooler. The wind is less strong and there's more organic matter in the soil. It holds what falls. It doesn't run off. It doesn't evaporate. It holds it and makes it available for the crop. Yeah, so, Mr. Tony, we're too much happy. And it's much, much deeper than just food and income. They're so proud. It's restored their dignity. Somebody did a study and they said, what do you feel? You know, they didn't ask all their usual questions. How many kilos of grain? How much firewood? How much money do you get from carbon credits? How do you feel? And one lady said, "You know, when we went to market in the past, we would walk nearly the whole distance in the burning sun. And there was nowhere to sit and rest." Choke up a bit. "Now the whole distance, nearly the whole distance, we walk through the shade." And another guy said, "We're so proud, so, so proud for ourselves, our village, for our country. This project's known in the whole world." You see what's happening here. You don't talk about these things in development normally, but it's actually touching on issues of dignity and pride and self-worth. And these are the real nuts and bolts of development. People start to determine their own future and to make wise decisions on how they manage what's been given to them. The sister project, very close to that one, 12 springs that have dried up have rejuvenated because more water is now soaking back into the water table and less flooding. One of the reasons why they're hungry, even in a wet year, was they'd get inundated. Their crops would be inundated, and those closest to the hill, they'd be buried under mud and rocks. All that stopped within 1 year of starting the reforestation work. And instead of that water running off and becoming an issue elsewhere, it was now soaking in and being slowly released by those springs and the organic soil. So I got to go back with Volker, the filmmaker. Have they continued? Is it still as effective? And it was so thrilling to go back. You saw the scenes with the people. They were so proud to take me out into the farms and to show me what they'd done and how well it was working. And even the things that they wouldn't adopt back then, they certainly adopted the FMNR, but there are other crazy ideas that I had. Even those things, not burning the straw and the husks and just different things. We introduced edible seeded acacias, and a number of people brought out their little store of acacia seed. Another guy who was cooking it commercially, he gave us the different things to taste. They just wanted to share what they'd done. And you can see there, you know, that these are the same areas where those barren earlier photos were taken. Even after a hard year, there's still a good scattering of trees there. They're not the same trees because we're still dealing with very, very poor people, but they're not letting that land go barren, and they're sustainably managing the regrowth. And what had been a negative spiral of degradation and hunger and poverty had become... I'm running out. My blood sugar's running low. It had become a virtuous cycle of restoration and diversity and relative prosperity. And whereas they were only growing millet, if they could grow it at all, given the rain, they are now growing a variety of crops because the microclimate had changed and the soil fertility had improved, and different livestock as well. We rarely saw free-range chickens and guinea fowls. They would feed them and keep them close to the village because there really wasn't much to eat out there in those barren fields. But we regularly saw it when we went back there. Because now if you leave the crop residue on the soil, in that climate we don't have earthworms, but we do have termites. And those chickens and guinea fowl are out there foraging and getting a free meal. And, the cycle of life has built up and become greatly enriched. So what I touched on there about the dignity and the pride, it's a real privilege for me to go back now into many of these areas and to see the difference that it's made in the lives of people. And there's this great joy. It's very, very moving. So where to for the... I think the next 10 years is going to be busier than ever. Weather patterns are changing and it's becoming harder and harder to grow food. And it will get harder still. More drought, higher temperatures, stronger, more severe storms. Many farmers now, particularly in Africa, but other parts of the world, they don't know when to plant. There used to be a regular season. They don't know what to plant because the season might be shorter or longer or so on. So it's very, very confusing. There'll be more social unrest, displacement and hunger. And there's this increasing urgency to address climate change. The beautiful thing about working with trees is it's win-win. You're improving the environment. At the same time, you're drawing down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. You're helping people to adapt. You're reducing temperatures. You're increasing soil fertility and so on. So there'll be more need to create awareness, greater needs in the field, and much, much greater opportunities. And I expect we'll be busier than ever if we've got the energy and God gives us the time. So my focus now, well, I can't do field work anymore. I don't manage projects anymore. There's people much more clever than me and people who do it a lot, lot better than me. But I think my focus should be on inspiring others and on enabling the next generation. So that's where I'm putting my efforts. And I mentioned that Ghana story. So the first time I visited there was 2009. And, I described the conditions there. It's very, very hard. And people, they're at the point, really, of wanting to give up. They're ready to abandon their ancestral land and move to Accra, the capital city, because they just couldn't make a go of it anymore. And for the old chief to make that statement, it really caught me. I thought, yes, yeah, that's a good summary of what Liz and I strive to do. Partnering with God in restoring nature to bring back life and joy. Thank you.